Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Just a fleeting bonus episode tonight, but nonetheless disturbing. Perhaps this one is for those religiously inclined, I originally thought, predisposed to ways of the Catholic Church, but actually in retrospect, maybe not entirely. On a warm August evening in 2017, a small group of nuns and priests met with a young woman within a chapel in upstate New York. Though the weather was warm, light and fresh outside, a noticeable and palpable chill set over the room. The priest began to pray whilst the young woman slipped into a trance, then quickly and entirely abruptly snapped back to life. She spoke in several distinct voices. One was deep, guttural and masculine. Another was high and pained. A third chanted in Latin. And a fourth was an elderly woman in tone and sound. A nun stepped forward and sprinkled water on the woman's forehead. She had no reaction. But when the nun switched it up and poured blessed holy water upon her, the woman screamed in agony, her sweat and body heat causing the holy water to release steam.
"Leave her alone, you bunch of cocksucking fucking priest whores,"
an elderly male voice echoed from the woman.
"Burn in the pits of hell, you come swallowing cunts."
Does this seem familiar? If you're a horror movie fan, or a Hollywood scholar, you will recognize these tropes a mile away. A soul corrupted by Satan, a priest waving a crucifix at a snarling and grotesque figure. Movies and literature have mimicked and sensationalized exorcism so often that they are now nothing more than cliché. Hollywood aims to top the last one. They must make the next one scarier, filthier, more chilling, and more obscene. But are we all just too desensitized to it to be that bothered anymore? Have we all seen it all before? I apologize, by the way, for the foul language used in the clips. In all honesty, however, the scenes I have just described, well, they were actually from a real exorcism. An exorcism that included a person who is not normally seen in the traditional late-night movie story arc. Dr. Elliot Goldwater is a Harvard-educated, board-certified psychiatrist who now teaches in Syracuse University and the New York Medical College. He was part of the team that night that was present when the priests and nuns tried to help the woman that I just mentioned. Indeed, fighting Satan's minions wasn't part of Goldwater's career plan while he was studying for his doctorate. Far from it, in fact. He knew, of course, about biblical accounts of demonic possession, but if he were to speak truthfully and openly, then he always thought that they were an ancient culture's attempt to understand mental disorders such as epilepsy or autism. But he is proud, however, to call himself a man of science. Yet today, Goldwater has added something more to his usual flavor, so to speak. He has become the go-to guy for a vast network of exorcists within the continental United States. He states demonic possession is real. He has the receipts. He has seen the evidence. Victims suddenly speak in perfect yet unknown ancient languages, writing in fluent Latin, objects flying off shelves, people displaying hidden knowledge or secrets about people that they could not possibly have known.
"You know, I don't doubt this is all very real, and I say that confidently as a man of science."
Goldwater pauses in thought for a moment.
"There was one instance I observed where a really petite woman, who must have been no more than like 90 pounds, soaking wet, she threw a Lutheran deacon, who was about 200 pounds heavier than her, across the room effortlessly. That's not psychiatry. That's beyond psychiatry.
Goldwater refers to himself as a consultant on demonic possessions. It's very true. I have his business card on my fridge. For the past 25 years, he has helped clergy distinguish between mental illness and what he refers to as the real thing. When we learned about mental health in the early 20th century, a lot of old superstition and religious claims did surprisingly fall off, or become few and far between at least. We felt that we had provided answers for a question that was thousands of years old. But the truth is that the two things run side by side with each other.
Yes, of course, there are provable and treatable mental health issues in people. But there are also provable and treatable cases of demonic possession within people. Of course, I accept that until you have seen it firsthand, it can be a difficult pill to swallow. Although, trust me, I think I have overdosed at this point.
Whenever I need help, I call on him, says Father Paul Trubenbach, a priest of St. Peter's and Paul's Orthodox Church in Salt Lake City, Utah. And we'll hear from him a little later. But Father Paul is at the forefront of exorcists in the United States. He also acknowledges that evil is lurking within every shadow, waiting to get its claws into the weak-minded and loose-willed. Dr. Goldwater is a tall guy. He stands at just over 6'5". He used this to his advantage in his college basketball days. He coyly admits he was pretty good at it back then. He's tall and he's thin, dressed all in black, with tight black jeans, a black shirt, and with the top two buttons undone, and a black suit jacket. There's an undeniable aura of cool about him when I speak to him via Skype from his home in Long Island.
My daughter would definitely disagree, but thank you.
When Dr. Goldwater talks about demonic possession, it sounds as if he's describing growing bacteria in a petri dish. His tone is dry, clinical, and matter of fact. It's a heavenly laden with science and technical isms. Possession, he says, is definitely rare, but definitely real.
I think I actually spend more time trying to convince people that they're not possessed than any amount of time to the opposite.
Indeed, this quote matches up with something that he wrote of similar ilk for The Guardian. Some critics, though, say Goldwater has become possessed by his own delusions, that he's been struck by the same snake oil that drowned the Warrens. Naysayers claim that he should be embarrassed because he's witnessed cheap parlor tricks and believed them, had the wool pulled over his eyes by the very people who might need therapy from someone just like him, but certainly not an exorcism. The same non-believers often cite the fact that there's no empirical evidence that proves possession is even real. Well, unproven and astonishing claims are what we specialize in here at Dead Souls, so we are more than happy to give Dr. Goldwater the time of day. And we aren't being biased or unscientific. We have seen the man's credentials, work, and qualifications, and trust us, they are extensive and official. But that aside, one of the biggest mysteries about Goldwater's work isn't what he's experienced or seen with his own eyes. It's how he's grown. How does a man of science get pulled into the world of demonic possession?
Well, there's a short answer to that, and it's a real doozy. And it's basically that time I met a demonic minion of Satan himself.
Oh. Okay. But to quote Goldwater further...
She was a middle-aged woman, and she wore flowing dark clothes and thick black eye makeup. She was entirely charming and engaging. She was so engrossing to speak to. She captivated your attention. But she was also part of a satanic cult. Within the cult, she referred to herself as the head minion of Satan, but I would just call her Susie. She looked like a Susie to me. She smirked when I called her that. I think she liked it. The woman had approached her local priest and was completely convinced that she was being attacked by an unfriendly demon. The priest completed his relevant checks and referred her to an exorcist. It was the exorcist who reached out to me for a mental health and scientific evaluation.
So I guess my first question would be, why would a devil worshipper want to be free of the devil? Why would a demon possess one of their own, so to speak?
She was definitely conflicted. There was There was a part of her that wanted to be relieved of the possession for sure. Maybe she got in too deep. And perhaps demons and those close to Satan don't really give a crap about your allegiances.
Susie ended up removing all doubt from within Goldwater. It was one of the first cases that he took, and it changed him forever. The doctor helped assemble an exorcism consultant team that met with Susie in the chapel in upstate New York.
Objects would fly off shelves around her. Honestly, you should have seen it. She somehow knew personal details about my life, my past, my family. How my mother had died of ovarian cancer. The fact that two cats in my house went berserk fighting each other the night before one of her sessions. How I had burned my daughter's toast several weeks before, and the petty argument it caused between me and my wife. She even became aware of details about a pet dog I had when I was 14.
Susie, it is alleged, even found a way to reach him, even when she wasn't with him, Goldwater says.
I was talking on the phone with her priest one night. Both me and the priest suddenly heard one of the demonic voices that regularly came from Susie during her trances. It spoke in Latin, we think. Now bear in mind, at this moment she was nowhere near a phone and thousands of miles away.
Dr. Goldwater says that he was never afraid, however. He insists that he's on the side of science more than anything else. He's not religious in any way, shape, or form. And he's definitely not one for superstition or folklore, he states. Dr. Goldwater says that he's a stickler for the scientific method, that it teaches people to follow the facts wherever they may lead, and that's important to him. Growing up in a large family on Long Island, he didn't ever much think about stories of possession. But when he kept seeing cases like Susie's as a professional, he says his views were forced to evolve. His younger brother Stuart says Dr. Goldwater was an academic prodigy with a photographic memory. He always wanted to use his talents to help people. We had a sensational childhood, Stu Goldwater says in an email I received from him. My mother and father were always helping our neighbors and taking part in the community. They were always so supportive of us, their children, no matter what we wanted to do. The Goldwater's mother was a kindergarten teacher, and their father was a local counselor. Dr. Goldwater's own way of helping the community, much like his parents, is by helping the mentally ill, as well as the demonically possessed. Those may seem at polar opposites, but they aren't that different, he says. The rite of exorcism was first published in 1614 by Pope Paul V to quell a trend of lay people and priests hastily performing makeshift exorcisms on people whom they presumed were possessed by evil forces. These included, at the time, bubonic plague victims. A line in the rite of exorcism states that the exorcist should be careful to distinguish between demon possession and melancholy, which was a catch-all for mental illness and suffering back then. The church knew, even in those days, that there were mental problems. It said the exorcist should not have anything to do with medicine. Leave that to the doctors. And that was 500 years ago. Well, there's actually a more recent and well-known case of what some perceive as demonic possession, yet others perceive as untreated mental health issues. It's a case that has divided people for over 40 years. It's a case so chilling and controversial that the events were born into a Hollywood movie titled The Exorcism of Emily Rose. Now, I have not seen the movie, but I would be keen to know how accurate it is to real events from those of you who have. Please, reach out. The true story that inspired the movie, however, is the real-life case of the exorcism of Annalise Michel. Believe it or not, the events actually ended up in court, but we'll get to that. Annalise Michel was born in the town of Klingenberg in Bavaria, Germany in 1952. She was raised in a strict Catholic family and was described by family and friends as very intelligent, friendly, and likable. In September 1968, Annalise would have been around 16 years old. She began to experience sporadic incidents of losing consciousness. The same night that these episodes started to happen, she stated that she felt as if something was pressing down on her chest, pinning her to the bed, and that she wasn't alone in her room, though no one visible was there. Around 11 months later, in August of 1969, another similar event occurred. Due to this happening more than once, her mother took Annalise to their family doctor, Dr. Vocht, and also a neurologist by the name of Dr. Luthi. Both men examined her and took several tests, including an EEG or brain scan, but found nothing abnormal. The two doctors hypothesized that a form of seizure was the likely explanation. Over the next 3 years, Annalise would have two more similar episodes and would be prescribed two medications to help curb the incidents: an anticonvulsant medication and also an anti-seizure medication called Dilantin. Annalise's EEG results would always come back normal on the number of occasions that she underwent them. There was seemingly nothing that could definitively explain her symptoms or episodes. In the spring of 1973, things took a turn for the worst. Sort of. Annalise began to hear knocking sounds within her bedroom, sounds that her sisters could also hear. But even more strange was that Annalise also reported hearing a voice that damned her to hell. Her mother was shaken when she witnessed Annalise furiously staring at a statue of the Virgin Mary, with what she said were, quote, eyes that had turned black, jet black, and hands that seemed to have turned into thick paws with sharp claws, unquote. In September 1973, during a visit with her neurologist, Dr. Luthi, Annalise described getting horrific visions of demonic faces that were tormenting her, and she said that she felt that the devil was inside her. She also told her family and doctors that she could constantly smell burnt feces. Later on, others that would be around Annalise would also report smelling the same aroma, but could not identify the source. Annalise's mother described strange occurrences to Dr. Luthi, who, according to Miss Michelle, advised her to consult with a Jesuit priest about her daughter's condition, although this would later be denied by Dr. Luthi. Of course, whether the advice was true or not, the family did eventually reach out to a priest named Father Alt to help them spiritually. In November 1973, Annalise met with a Freudian psychiatrist who diagnosed her as a neurotic with probable epilepsy. Another neurologist found that she had epileptic patterns and withdrew her Dilantin medication, replacing it instead with Tegretol, a much stronger drug. By July 1975, Annalise's extremely bizarre behavior had worsened. She barely ever slept and prayed fervently all night, each night. She would eat spiders and flies and often licked up her own urine from the floor. Annalise angrily destroyed rosaries, crucifixes, and holy pictures from the walls. She exhibited strength that was said to be close to superhuman, and even threw her own sister as if she were a rag doll, witnesses said. She was observed effortlessly squeezing an apple with one hand into fragments which exploded throughout the room. Witnesses couldn't believe who they were seeing. The transformation of Annalise from a polite, quiet, and friendly young girl into a gaunt, dark, and deathly-looking creature was staggering. A priest named Father Roderick, who was widely considered an expert on exorcisms by his peers, reported that he was convinced that Annalise was possessed, and after deliberation with the bishop, an exorcism was formally approved. It was to be conducted by Father Renz. On September the 24th, 1975, the first exorcism rite of Annalise Michel was performed by Renz. He allowed some of the exorcism sessions to be recorded, and 42 audio recordings of the exorcism were made in total. I'm going to play some clips from these recordings now. But just to warn you, these recordings are pretty disturbing, so I strongly advise caution beyond this point. For clarity, the audio is in German, as Annalise and everyone involved in the case were all German. The first clip that you will hear will be of Annalise as a fit, young and well young lady, way before the possession began. The second set of clips will be Annalise during her possession.
ja, ich will auch für die anderen leiden, damit die nicht mehr kommen und so. Aber dass das dann so schlimm ist und so grausam und so furchtbar, nee. Das sind mir leiden, das ist so, so leicht zu haben. Wenn es dann wirklich schlimm wird, da will man überhaupt nicht mehr, da will mein Kind schon.
This clip was just Annalise having a conversation with her doctor in everyday life. This next clip is audio of Annalise in the throes of possession. Caution.
Sind wir schon drei?
This final clip is of Annalise recorded during one of the exorcism rites. As I'm sure you'll agree, these recordings do not make for easy listening. Annalise named Fleischmann as one of her demons. She would provide accurate details of the real Valentin Fleischmann, who was a 16th century priest that was expelled from the Catholic Church for murder and generally being a shady and unsavory guy. These details came as a shock to Father Alt, who stated that Annalise would have no way of knowing who Fleischmann was. Even by today's standards and having the internet so easily accessible, there still isn't much information about Father Fleischmann out there. But she seemed to know a huge amount. By May of 75, Annalise became even worse. She would spend her days banging her head against the wall and biting herself and anyone else who came close enough. Her family would at this point have to restrain her and keep her that way in an attempt to prevent her from hurting herself. Annalise also refused to eat. She would describe the sensation as her not being permitted to do so. Despite being frail and weighing less than 80 pounds, she exhibited great strength when people tried to restrain her. But Annalise's entire face had become sunken in. She refused any further doctor visits, even though she had a very high fever. On June 30th, Annalise underwent another exorcism, uttering just two words during the experience. Quote, "Please, absolution," unquote. The next morning, her family went into her room and found her dead. Despite initially seeking medical attention, Annalise would go on to refuse any and all further medical attention, and her family ultimately placed all faith of recovery into the exorcisms. She essentially died of starvation at the age of 23, following 67 exorcisms. She weighed 68 pounds at the time of her death. Following her death, Annalise's parents and the two priests involved in spiritual consultation were accused of negligent homicide and prosecuted. The case went to trial in 1978. Ultimately, the defense argued that Annalise was possessed by a wicked demon that would not release her and slowly suck the life from her. The prosecution alleged that Annalise suffered from significant mental health issues and medical malpractice, and negligence from all involved in her care led directly to her death. But how do you tell the difference between demonic possession and mental health issues? Was it a case of mental illness, possibly epilepsy, or was there a legitimate case of demonic possession here? Whatever the real reason may be, the case of Annalise Michel is a tragedy and will always be shrouded in mystery. The Michel family and the two priests involved in the exorcisms of Annalise Michel were found guilty of negligent homicide by a German court in April 1978. They were sentenced to 2 years suspended sentences and payment of court costs. Dr. Mark Atherton is another medical professional who believes demonic possession is real. Atherton studied medicine at Cornell University and has been practicing psychiatry for several decades. Atherton says there is a growing belief among health professionals that a patient's spiritual dimension should be accounted for within treatment, whether their provider agrees with those beliefs or not. Some psychiatrists have even talked of adding a trance of possession disorder diagnosis to the DSM, the Diagnostic Manual of Disorders used by mental health professionals in the United States. There's still so much about the human mind that psychiatrists don't know. Doctors used to be widely skeptical of people who claim to suffer from multiple personalities, but now it's a legitimate disorder. Many are still dumbfounded by the power of placebos, a harmless pill or medical procedure that produces healing in some cases. There's a certain openness to experiences that are happening that are beyond what we can explain by MRI scans, neurobiology, or even psychological theories. We have to be prepared to accept that there is more out there that is yet to be discovered. We have to be accepting of growing our knowledge and understanding. Here are some thoughts and comments from the previously mentioned Father Paul Treubenbach, the priest from Salt Lake City who regularly works alongside Dr. Elliot Goldwater.
The Orthodox Christian has to be constantly aware that the invisible world is always active. We're extremely cautious with everything, including ourselves. We recognize that any thought or impulse we have may be from God, but it also may just be psychological from us, or it may be from the demons. And we have to recognize in all humility that we probably don't have the discernment to distinguish one from another. Well, you know, the great saints and elders have that discernment. When we don't have that discernment, we tend to be pretty distrustful of ourselves, which is why we go to our spiritual father. But we are ever aware of the demonic world around us. At the same time, we're not hyper-focused on it. We don't become obsessed with it. We don't give more attention than it's due. And I think this is spiritually one of the dangers that people make, is that when they do have something happening in their spiritual life that they feel is demonic, sometimes if you begin to really worry about it and give it more focus than it's due, you actually strengthen it. You know, for instance, people are sometimes surprised when they have what are their logies me? What are these random thoughts that comes up? That's particularly kind of crazy. You know, I'm driving down the road and out of the blue, I have a thought with my kids in the back of the car to jerk the wheel and careen my car off the road and kill us all. And you know, it's a fleeting thought, it's in and out. And I go, I've never had a thought like that before. What just happened? Well, if I give it hyper-focus, I'm gonna sit there and I'm gonna strengthen it. I'm gonna start worrying about it. I'm gonna start giving it a power that it doesn't otherwise have. But if in those moments we can learn to say, I'm going to put my thoughts right back on Christ and just say, Lord, I know that thought was crazy. That didn't come from me. Clearly didn't come from you. Banish those thoughts from me and then go right back to your prayer life and your world of peace. You're going to be better off. I teach people all the time. I tell them one of the greatest spiritual tools I can give them is called the Holy Shrug. And the Holy Shrug is to take something that has happened and just say, yeah, okay, and go back to normal life.
There's plenty of food for thought in tonight's brief episode, no matter what your faith or scientific belief. And I will clarify that personally, I'm not covering this subject from a place of religious belief. In fact, I have none. My thoughts are entirely scientific and secular. But that said, it's important to hear the thoughts and experiences of others, and to be able to accept that there are things out there that we just don't understand. What do you think? Get in touch. As always, I'm eager to hear your thoughts on tonight's episode.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.